Good morning, University of Manitoba campus, and welcome to UMFM's information and entertainment program, Your Campus Today. For Friday, September 28th, I'm going to be your host, David Defane. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 11:30 a.m., we bring you all the U of M news that's fit for your ears, plus keep you in the loop on just a few of the great events going on here at the U of M campus that you need to know about. On today's show, we celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the opening of Migazi-Agamik, the 50th anniversary of the National Resources Institute here on campus, and speak with the organizers of the first-ever Manitoba Podcast Festival. All this and more coming up next, right here on Your Campus Today. A long-time dream became a reality in 2008 when Migazi-Agamik Bald Eagle Lodge officially opened its doors at the University of Manitoba. The idea for the building, which offers a dedicated space on campus for Indigenous students, first took shape in the 1970s when student leaders Ovid Mercredi, Elijah Harper, Edwin Jeb, and Moses Okima advocated for and established one of the first Native student associations in Canada. That same group also successfully lobbied for a Department of Native Studies and an Aboriginal Student Center here on the campus. Rumblings of a building devoted to bringing together Indigenous students, academics, and services continued to gain momentum in 1989 when the Aboriginal Student Center director, Callie Storm, was hired. Migazi-Agamik was a dream of a safe space for Indigenous students on campus where we could create a sense of community founded on Indigenous beliefs and practices, she says. Storm explains that Dr. Lara Fitznor, an associate professor in the Faculty of Education, and Dr. Fred Shore, an assistant professor in the Department of Native Studies, led a group that would eventually turn the dream of Migazi-Agamik into a reality. I was fortunate enough to be part of the team and learned a great deal from all of its members over the many years it was around, advocating for Indigenous students, staff, faculty, community, and programs, she says. After years of discussion, design plans for Migazi-Agamik officially began in 2004. Prairie Architects Incorporated was hired to oversee the physical vision for the building. The team included Eladia Smoke, Destiny Seymour, and Dave Thomas, all of whom were Indigenous architecture students here at the University of Manitoba. We wanted the building designed by Indigenous people, says Indigenous Student Center advisor Carl Stone, a vital voice for the Indigenous community on campus since the mid-1990s. We even wanted the construction workers to be Indigenous so that it was Indigenous all the way, and Prairie Architects made sure of that. In October 2005, the building's creation was confirmed. Elder Gary Robson held a ceremony laying tobacco down on the four corners of the lot where Migazi-Agamik would be constructed. A prayer was made to Mother Earth to build on the land. The following spring, consultations among elders, students, and members of the community and university began. The emotion was that we needed to get it right, and I remember some elders saying this, Stone explained. I knew the opening of this building was going to be a significant event for this university, and significant for Indigenous people coming to this university, because there was nowhere else on campus other than the Aboriginal Student Center where we tried to create space for Aboriginal students. The new building would not only be home to the Aboriginal Student Center, but also act as a hub for services, programs such as Access and Aboriginal Focus Programs, the University of Manitoba Aboriginal Students Association, Department of Native Studies faculty, and the Office of Accessibility. A number of elders were brought in to help with the cultural aspects of the building, including Roger Armit, then elder-in-residence for the Aboriginal Student Center, as well as Anne Callahan and Charlie Nelson. Also involved were Florence Paytner and Robson, who eventually became the first elders-in-residence at Migazi-Agamik. Construction officially began in early 2007 after nearly 2 years of consultation and fundraising. 10 years ago, with a ribbon cutting in June and an official opening on September the 19th, Migazi-Agamik opened to the public. It didn't take long for Indigenous students to feel its impact. Former Anishinaabe student Nadia Green was affected by its presence on campus. She grew up on Barron's River First Nations and recalled feeling, quote, vulnerable and, quote, kind of alone as an Indigenous student on campus prior to the building's opening. But as soon as she stepped through its doors, she felt a sense of community. I remember thinking that this is what I need right now, she explained. Whenever I'd be stressed out, I would just have to go to the center, and I would feel a boost of energy, and that feeling that you were supported. I didn't even have to talk to anyone. I would just have to go there to feel the buzz of the building with all the other students, and it felt like I wasn't alone. It took close to 3 years for the building to be officially named. Tobacco was passed to Elder Charlie Nelson in early 2011, and a few months later he came up with Migazi-Agamik, the Bald Eagle Lodge. A feast, pipe, and water ceremony were all held after the building was named. The name came to Nelson in a dream, where a scared little boy saw a bald eagle come out of the clouds to calm everything down. Even though there's all this other stuff going on in the dream, the main character was that bald eagle, because it was the bald eagle that calmed everyone down, explained Carl Stone, advisor at the Indigenous Student Center. The bald eagle calms the energy of those facing the challenges of a strong force. It captured the spirit of the building. 10 years later, Miggy Agamit's impact is still felt. Fourth-year Métis student Jillian McIver is one of the many current students benefiting from its presence on campus. Since I've been getting involved here, it's been a really nice feeling to have a support group and also to be able to learn more about my identity and to be a leader in the Indigenous community, she said. McIver's words resonate with Brenda Lee Lafreniere, a counselor with the Access and Aboriginal Focus programs, whose vision is for the next generation of Indigenous students to continue the work already being done on campus and within the building. The design and the stories that go along with this building, we hope that the future generations will continue with, and those stories, and provide their own voices, she said. You have the voice, use it, and follow it through with actions that can provide leadership and phenomenal change. This building is an example of that. It's going to survive generations, but not only that, the spirit and the teachings that go along with it are also alive and will live on through it. The Natural Resources Institute, the NRI, at the University of Manitoba is marking a significant milestone this year, celebrating its 50th anniversary. In 1968, the Natural Resources Institute opened its doors and offered a master's degree program in natural resources management as a response to problems arising from traditional approaches to natural resources development. At the time, adverse consequences on the environment and the loss of renewable and non-renewable resources had arisen as major public policy concerns. Today, the NRI proudly offers two interdisciplinary graduate degree programs, a Master's in Natural Resources Management, MNRM, and a PhD in Natural Resources and Environmental Management, or NREM. This September and throughout October, the NRI is celebrating 50 years of success in advanced interdisciplinary education, research, and community service on resource and environment management. The impact of the department's work have been felt throughout the province and around the globe. The NRI has a well-deserved reputation for a distinction in the fields of education and research. Our work has seen students and instructors directly working on resource issues with communities in Manitoba and in countries such as India, Brazil, Grenada, Mexico, and Kenya. We look forward to connecting and celebrating with our outstanding alumni and others that have contributed so much to our success over the last 50 years, says Dr. John Sinclair, acting director of the Institute. The NRI's 50th anniversary gala dinner will take place on Saturday, October 27th, 2018, with cocktails at 5:30 p.m. and a sit-down dinner at 6:30 p.m. at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, the first national museum to be built in nearly half a century and the first outside the national capital region. This event will offer a unique opportunity for everyone to meet the NRI's alumni, faculty, and staff and celebrate the accomplishments of the Institute with dinner and live entertainment at a historically significant site. We encourage our alumni to contact friends and former classmates to come as a group. Tickets to the dinner are a reasonable $50 for the general public and $25 for students. Seating is limited and tickets can be purchased through the NRI's website, umanitoba.ca/institutes/NRI50. This year, as part of Nuit Blanche Winnipeg's Illuminate the Night program, Neil MacArthur, Director, Center for Professional and Applied Ethics, will be doing an installation called the St. Boniface Bicycle Drive-In Movie Theater. He is working with Alana Thane from McGill University. The installation is inspired by a series Alana started called Cinema Out of the Box, which brings cinema to unconventional locations around Montreal. The St. Boniface Bicycle Drive-In Movie Theater is an old-fashioned drive-in movie theater with a twist. It's meant for people on bikes, and the viewers don't just watch. The film's projection and sound take all of their power from a bicycle-powered generator. The attendees have to take turns pedaling to power the projector, and as they negotiate who will take turns powering the movie, and as they sit parked next to each other in our space, we hope people will talk to one another and get to know each other. The drive-in movie theater is a site of nostalgia for many people. It certainly is for me. Drive-ins were public spaces that allowed people to experience cinema collectively in the open air in an environment that, unlike an indoor theater, allowed them to socialize freely. What Neil loved about the old drive-in movie theaters was this sociability. People met their friends there, and they actually talked to strangers as well. They moved around through the space, they chatted openly while the movie was happening, and of course they drank and made out. It was fun. It feels like in our modern world, we've lost so many of these social spaces where people can hang out with their friends and actually just talk to people in real life. That's what we wanted to create. Yet the drive-in's legacy is a complicated one. It also epitomized an automobile-based and petroleum-dependent culture, one that placed cars at the very heart of social existence. The theaters required a flight from urban heartlands, and vehicles were often left running for hours while the films played. The bicycle drive-in both evokes this nostalgia and interrogates it. It models a new form of cinematic viewing that is urban, sustainable, and participatory, while preserving the information and the sociability of the traditional drive-in. We wanted to recreate the drive-in according to the new model, as a social space that is also sustainable. The St. Boniface location is important to me, said MacArthur. I've lived here for more than a decade, and I feel like it's an ideal place to try and create a social space like this. People are friendly and have a sense of community, but they don't always have opportunities to actually meet one another. We wanted to give people one night where they can turn off the Netflix and watch films alongside other people. The films will be short ones made by independent filmmakers from Manitoba and Quebec. They will be in both French and English, and they will center around the theme of energy and illumination. The project is sponsored by the Winnipeg Arts Council and the Nuit Blanche Winnipeg. It takes place Saturday, September 29th, beginning at 7 p.m. and runs all night. It is in the parking lot across from the St. Boniface Public Library on Taché. The event is free and open to all, even people without bikes. Up next on Your Campus Today, special correspondent Michael Elves is going to be joined by three of the organizers of the first ever Manitoba Podcast Festival, Sam Thompson, Stefan Richard, and Roger Boyer. The event takes place at the Park Theater this Sunday afternoon from noon until 4. Let's go to that now.
All right, well, the Manitoba Podcast Festival set to debut this weekend, and joining us on the phone, Sam Thompson, Stefan Richard, and Roger Boyer, all involved in organizing this festival. Welcome.
Thanks.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, hello.
So each of you are involved with, you know, your own sort of individual podcasts, and podcasting in itself, I mean, yes, you have guests, but it's kind of ultimately kind of like working in isolation or, you know, working kind of by yourselves. How did you guys determine, like, we should put together a festival and kind of explore this as a group activity?
Go ahead.
I think you want to, go ahead.
I was going to say, I was a guest on Stefan's show, his show, The Ever Sick Podcast, and we kind of talked about podcasting during that episode, and sort of after the interview ended, we just started talking about how we should, you know, we should try to do something more. You know, we had a lot of similar interests as far as podcasting went. And there was obviously a community being built around it. So we thought we should put something together, and this is kind of what ended up.
So when you say a community being built around it, like what do you identify as sort of the podcasting community?
Well, I think there's a lot of people in Winnipeg who are trying to do something similar to what all of us are doing. And for the most part, it's been fairly, as you said, like, you know, individuals doing their own shows. And so I think the more people sort of network and get to know each other and get to know what each other are doing, the kind of the stronger it gets, because, you know, whether it's guesting on each other's shows or just getting the word out about each other's shows or just becoming listeners of what each other are doing, it's making it kind of a stronger community, whereas before it was a bunch of lone individuals working on their own things.
Yeah, I think the idea of, like, Sam coming on my show and then from that growing the podcast festival. Even when Sam and I were talking, we were talking about other podcasts that we listen to in the city, and we kind of thought, hey, it would be great to reach out to them, and not necessarily just to be on our own, like, each other's shows, but just to kind of, like, say, hey, what are you doing? What kind of equipment are you using? How are you getting guests? How are you interviewing them? What are the challenges? What are the successes? It kind of grew from there.
So it goes from that initial idea to then, you know, how do we think bigger about this? And, you know, how do you build, like, a festival itself then? Like, because there's, like, you know, identifying the different podcasts, people that are doing podcasts, but, like, you know, programming-wise, what do you kind of figure out as far as, like, what's of interest, what necessitates a panel or group or talk?
Sure. Well, I think that the main goal is to sort of, like we mentioned, kind of get the people who are already doing it together and just, you know, network basically and find out how we're doing our shows, who's listening, how we get more listeners, how we can share listeners. but also to encourage new people who might want to try it to start out. And even though podcasting is a very easy thing to get into, it doesn't require a lot of equipment. You could pretty much start it, you know, today if you wanted to do one. But there's a lot of, I think there's a barrier for a lot of people who don't realize they can just, you know, pull out a recording device and go. And there's a lot of questions people have just on sort of how they do it. Someone might have a great idea, but might have never interviewed someone before and might need some tips on that. And so a lot of the point behind the festival is to say, you know, if you have an idea and you want to do it, we're here to answer questions. Our panels are here to talk about kind of the everything that goes into making a podcast, especially DIY podcasts, and to just sort of give people an opportunity to ask questions and then sort of get involved, introduce themselves to people who are already doing this, and hopefully grow the community that way.
I think the whole idea of the actual festival, pulling the trigger on putting something like this together, was born out of something Roger was doing, and Roger could probably speak a little bit better to it, but the Indigenous Film Summit, which was essentially this kind of a similar idea, but just based around film and the film industry. And Roger and a group of partners put that together, and he'd probably be able to speak about that a little bit better.
Yeah, I think networking with other like-minded individuals and other professionals in the industry or area you're interested in always really helps you grow. And I think knowing how podcast is a growing it's a growing industry, and I think the fact that the three of us, along with a lot of other podcasters we know, I think networking with each other and helping each other grow, it will just we can make Winnipeg a really a podcast community, and I think that's you know, that's going to be important going forward. A lot of people, the way the podcast is growing. So,
Roger, did you take any ideas or experiences or kind of learned tips from the Indigenous Film Summit to apply to the podcast festival when you guys were organizing?
Oh well, so I guess just to quickly reiterate, yeah. So this past June, we organized the first ever Indigenous Film Summit in Canada, as far as I know. But it was a great success, and I think a lot of those ideas, a lot of those experiences, knowing how we should have a good mix of beginners and a mix of professionals who want to network with one another, and even just to get ideas or maybe even sponsorships and growing audience tips. I think a few of those ideas came from there too, just from that experience.
So then you've got the idea. How do you go about like finding, you know, securing a venue and getting people on board? Like, is it just a lot of legwork?
I think, yeah, we should. That's Sam's area.
Yeah, no, the venue, it's at the Park Theater, and I have a relationship with the Park Theater already over the course of doing my show. I've done some shows there, some live podcasts there in the past, and, you know, I've worked with them before, and they've been very supportive of this kind of thing in general. I know this is the first podcast festival, but even when I had ideas years ago about doing live podcasts, they were very open to, like, yeah, let's try it, sure, let's see how it works. So, it helps that it's probably the best venue in the city for music and everything anyway. And it's super cool that they're letting us do this at the park, because it's it could very easily have been in someone's basement or something, you know, based on the kind of DIY level of what podcasting is. But having it at the Park Theater, I think, definitely lends some legitimacy to it. As you know, this is a real thing. These are people who are really invested in doing what they're doing, and hopefully that encourages people to come out.
I think the idea that all three of us have had live podcasts and experience booking a venue and getting tickets, and just the idea of a podcast being something like DIY and downloadable, and you can take it on the go and stop and start whenever you wish, and you can save it for 6 weeks. But the actual idea of getting somebody out physically out of their home and driving to a venue and paying for a ticket is something we've all had experience with. So the idea of putting this together was not foreign to us, but this, I feel like this is part of what we can pass on to up-and-coming podcasters or people who, you know, who have already had this experience. We can share our experience with other people.
Stefan and Sam, earlier this month, you participated in a Creative Manitoba panel on podcasts. Yeah. I'm wondering, did that kind of serve as like a little bit of a dry run for this podcast festival and some of the paneling that you anticipate? Or
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it was really successful. We had a packed house there, and it was actually interesting because I wasn't sure what to expect from the audience at that event, and it was very diverse. I mean, especially in terms of age, a lot of the questions we were getting were from people who are, you know, quite a bit older than us. And I was expecting it to be all young people because podcasting kind of is stereotyped, I guess, as a younger person's format. But we had a lot of really interesting questions from people who, you know, they had blogs, they wanted to know how to add a podcast to that, and all other kinds of things. So if that's a template for how the festival is going to work, I think we'll be very successful. It was definitely our first attempt at trying something like this, and it couldn't have gone better.
Yeah, it was pretty terrific. And Sam was very lucky to be moderating the podcast panel, and I was one of the guests, and I'm not used to being the one answering all the questions, so it was kind of difficult for me. But I think at one point I grabbed the microphone from Sam and started asking other people questions too. But it was a good dry run, and I'm really looking forward to Sunday.
Well, each of you are going to be serving as moderator. Is that correct at some point?
Yeah, we'll be doing I think the three of us are going to sit down for like an intro.
Sure.
Yeah, I'll be hosting one podcast. Sam, I believe, is hosting another. And then all three of us, to kind of kick off the day, we'll be doing not necessarily a keynote speech, but just kind of like a welcoming address.
Right. So then obviously, drawing on your experience as host of the podcast, you have kind of like conditioned yourself to be moderator of these kind of panels in some sense.
I think so, yeah. I think we have the experience anyway of having talked to people, whether it's live or just, you know, in the usual format. So we have definitely the background of doing it. So that helps, right?
Yeah, especially Sam, who's interviewing musicians and bands, and the ability to switch between one to five people in an interview is a skill that people need to have. So like for Sam to do it would be great, for me to do it would be great, for Roger to do it would be great. But like this is all part of the learning process. Maybe for somebody who hasn't hosted a podcast, is interested, you know, to like pick brains and ask panel members questions, and just an overall like real learning experience for everybody involved, especially us, because this is our first time doing something of this magnitude.
Speaking of learning experiences, Stefan, you finished up Eversick and you're doing digital drum for APTN. Moving from like kind of like primarily talk to now music pod, like did you find that there was a learning experience in that kind of shift?
Yeah, it really was, because I had wrapped the Eversick podcast. It had run for about 2.5 years. About a year into my run, APTN approached me to host digital drum. And when they asked me to do it, I sat with them, and I was just real frank with them. I was like, listen, I'm not a music guy. Like, I don't know anything about music. And they were really supportive. Mainly, they wanted an indigenous host, so I fit that role. But they wanted somebody who could really ask genuine questions and not go over anyone's head. So I think the learning curve was just accepting my role as, like, a legitimate person who was curious about the music and curious about the people. So the learning curve was like, you don't have to know everything right away. You can jump in and learn as you go, and that's what I've done. And now we are heading into our third season next year, and it's been a success just because of that learning curve.
I think that's something that Stefan just said is important to note too, because a lot of people might be under the impression that in order to host a podcast, you need to have some kind of a journalism background. And that's obviously not the case. I mean, Stefan's doing the digital drum podcast, which is, you know, a very high profile music show here in the in Canada, I guess, really. And, you know, he doesn't come from, you know, being a radio background. He's working in radio now as a career, but I mean, you definitely don't have to have any of that training. It helps, but you can learn it. Learning to do an interview, learning to talk on air or talk in a live setting, it's something you can pick up. And I think that hopefully the panels at the festival will kind of give people an idea that you don't necessarily need this background. I mean, I have a journalism background, but it's mainly in print journalism, which, you know, when I started doing the podcast, talking on air was something I hadn't done before. And it's just something you can develop. So I think that hopefully there's a learning opportunity for people to want to take on that stuff.
Definitely, especially like Roger. Roger's a film guy, you know, and when Roger and I started our podcast, we started roughly about the same time, within probably about a month of each other. It was like Roger was behind the scenes producer, director, writer, and he could probably speak a little bit better to that. But just we both had this like, we really don't know what we're doing, but we're just going to try it anyway.
Yeah, you figure it out. And I think it was fun. It was challenging, but it was something we both wanted to do. And I think with Stefan along, we started with Adeline Bergsmeyer. She would be a panelist. And the three podcasts started around the same time, and I think it's just a good time to get into it, and it's something we all really enjoy. And if you're a podcaster, it's definitely something you should really come on Sunday.
Right. So that's Sunday at the Park Theater. Starts at noon. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's an afternoon event. Actually, Sunday is International Podcast Day, which was a thing that none of us, I think, even knew existed, but the timing worked out fantastically well. But yeah, we're doing panels throughout the day. It's going from noon to four. And yeah, it's going to be a fun afternoon.
And it's
and part of the afternoon is going to be like, the fun part is in between the panels, when the panelists come off and we have, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes to network with everybody between each panel. That's going to be just as fun as the panel stuff.
And I know tickets are $5. Are they available in advance or is this just at the door kind of a thing?
Both.
And what's the best place? I mean, I know you guys have a Facebook event page and there's a Twitter handle and stuff. What's the best kind of social media source for kind of keeping tabs on things?
Really, any of them are good. You know, we've been posting the panelists just to give some background on who's going to be there on all the Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. So really anywhere you can find it, the details should be available.
It's the Manitoba Podcast Festival. Sam, Stefan, and Roger, thanks very much for joining us on your campus today.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally, one more reminder about the free pancake breakfast kickoffs homecoming football day tomorrow, September 29th. The football game itself starts at 2. Be sure to get there early for pregame party fun. And get to the U of M bookstore this Friday and Saturday for 20% off Bison gear. So that's today and tomorrow for 25% off Bison gear. There is no better day to don your brown and gold and show off your Bison pride than this Saturday at the homecoming football game. So that's tomorrow, September 29th. Festivities get underway at 11 a.m. at Investors Group Field with a free pancake breakfast provided by Smitty's, followed by a pregame party from noon to 2 p.m. hosted by Ace Burpee and Virgin 103. There will be live music, face painting, food and beverage specials, giveaways, and more. It's going to be an absolute blast. Bring 5 friends and get there early. Remember, U of M students get in for absolutely free. The Bisons are going to be defending home field against a Regina Rams team with a matching 2-2 regular season record. The game won't be disappointing as both teams are looking to push forward into the postseason play. Kickoff once again is at 2 p.m. You can also find the event on PostEd. And that's just about it for us here this week on Your Campus Today. We're going to be closing out our show with a selection from the new Brandon Coleman record, Resistance. Thanks for listening, everybody, and have an excellent homecoming weekend. We're going to be back on Monday to kick off the week. As always, I've been me, you've been you. My name is David Defane, and this has been Your Campus Today. Your Campus Today is a collaborative production between UM Today, the Manitoban, the Department of Student Life, and this station, UMFM 101.5. Thanks for listening, folks. If you have a story you'd like us to feature or want to send in feedback, please email us at campustoday@umfm.com.